Take a journey through history with a new podcast from St. Luke's Historic Church and Museum, hosted by me, John Erickson. Join the conversation with scholars and historians as we tackle subjects like race, women's history, and constitutional law. Explore how the pursuit of religious freedom in colonial America has shaped our modern life. Tune in to History from the Old Brick Church podcast today, available on all major podcast platforms.
Are you craving discussions about the past without the ego? You're in the right spot. Here, humility and engaging conversations reign supreme. These are stories that leave a mark. This is the Tattooed Historian Show. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Tattooed Historian Show. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you've been enjoying the podcast this year so far. We've been doing this bi-weekly podcast, and it's really helped me greatly with doing some other work involving my PhD studies and being able to give you some good quality stuff. It really does mean a lot that you are tuning in. The numbers are fantastic, and I'm sure this particular episode is going to get a lot of great numbers, because I have Cecily Zander on this particular podcast to talk about the Army Under Fire, the politics of anti-militarism in the Civil War era. And I have to say, I've heard some of these stories before, but I never put it together in the way that Cecily has done. And that really means a lot to me as someone who studied history for many years, that I love to see someone come in and take me down a route that I didn't consider before and make me think about things differently. Some people get really entrenched in their ways and they don't want to hear this new stuff, but I'm one of those people who will cheer on anyone who wants to make us think about that era or any other era in a different way through the use of primary sources and good context. And Cecily does a great job with that. This was a fantastic interview. I was so happy to have her on to discuss it. I'm sure we'll be back together again on some digital thing in the future that you'll be able to watch. But for now, I'm so happy that you're here to listen to this episode of the Tattooed Historian Show. This is Cecily Zander talking about her book, The Army Under Fire, The Politics of Anti-Militarism in the Civil War Era. Cecily, it's so great to have you on to discuss your fantastic work, The Army Under Fire, The Politics of Anti-Militarism in the Civil War Era. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, John. Thanks for making time for me. I know it's later there in Canada than it is here in Texas. So
it's just a little bit later, but that's okay. It's only an hour. It's fine. At least I'm warm, right?
Yeah. Well, it was 85 here today. So, you know, I don't know what that is in Celsius, but still pretty warm.
That's okay. I'm an American, so I go back and forth between the degrees. And today, I believe we had a heat wave. We got up over 50 degrees today. So
wow,
that's weird for here.
Yeah, for March. Yeah, we had a 90 degree day last week in February, and I was a little concerned. Yeah. I won't lie.
I don't miss that because the bugs are bigger. And
they're out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not a bug guy, so that's not
me neither.
I'll take the cold, and I have to. I'm one of those guys who's a wuss and has to yell for his wife to come get the spider. So it's not. I'm a terrible husband, but I'm so glad to finally meet you digitally and to have read your book, which we're going to go into here in a little bit from LSU Press. But Cecily, I would love for you to talk with everyone listening about how history started for you. What was the spark that really got you interested in the past?
Okay, yeah, it's a good question. And it's a question that kind of explains why I wrote the book I wrote in the end. I was born and raised in Colorado, near Boulder, Colorado. So grew up in the West, consider myself a Westerner, love the mountains. And both my parents, my whole family, were from North Dakota, so practically Canadians in some ways. And so we would spend most of our summers driving across Wyoming and South Dakota, Montana, North Dakota. And my dad specifically is from Mandan, which is where Lewis and Clark spent their winters going back and forth to the Pacific with the Corps of Discovery, actually a little north of present-day Mandan in a town called Washburn, but also where the U.S. Army built Fort Abraham Lincoln after the Civil War, which is where George Custer and the 7th Cavalry were stationed before they went on their vacation to Montana and did not come back. And I think, you know, for good or for ill, when I was about 5 or 6, I'd been there enough times that I could probably have given you the start of a lecture about George Custer and the U.S. Army on the frontier. Mm-hmm. So it was that kind of physical history. It was those public history sites. It was those public historians and interpreters who brought the past to life. And I think that's irresistible for a young child. The Fort Abraham Lincoln site also features the earth lodges, reconstructed earth lodges of the Mandan Indian Nation, which were just amazing to see as a kid. So also this kind of sense of cross-cultural connection. And it was just a normal part of my growing up that we would spend our summers visiting these historic sites. Fort Laramie, I mean, in Wyoming. I've been to Mount Rushmore more times than I can count. So I think I naturally tended toward it. I was kind of a speech and debate kid in high school. I was interested in history, interested in politics, interested in kind of rhetoric and writing. And I always loved to read. So my brother and I are total opposites in this regard. He had the exact same experience as me growing up, and he's become a carpenter. So we did very different directions. And so I wouldn't say it was anything that was forced. I'm sure my parents are still a little bit confused, though. One of my mentors did ask my mom once if they had a sense I might become a historian. And she sort of pondered it for a second and said, well, she did ask us to tape the Antiques Roadshow on PBS. So it was probably a sign. Yeah. And so I knew that Western history super, super well, or I felt like I did. And then I decided, I don't know, radical decision, wanted to get away from where I grew up. So I decided to go to college in Virginia. On the one hand, I think I got waitlisted a lot of places. I only got in a couple. I was really fortunate to get into the University of Virginia. So I thought, hey, it's going to be the same, basically the same price tag. So kind of why not go on an adventure? And as you might imagine, the University of Virginia being situated where it is, you can either become really interested in Thomas Jefferson or the Civil War. Those are kind of your two choices.
Right.
And, you know, Thomas Jefferson is nice, but I thought, you know, why not kind of really delve into the Civil War? And what attracted me to it was the fact that I knew all of the names already. I just knew them in a different context. So I knew them in their Western context. I knew who Sherman and Sheridan and Custer were, but I knew them for what they had done in the West, not what they had done in the Civil War. And so it was like kind of piecing together an incomplete story that I had kind of getting into the Civil War in college and then in grad school, deciding that's kind of what I wanted to study. As you know, when you go to grad school, they basically tell you, you got to pick, you know, it's still okay to love all of history, but you have to kind of pick your focus. And what I increasingly found in the literature that I was reading about the Civil War was there was this impression that the Civil War created a new American army, that it was more powerful. It was more equipped to go into the West and complete the kind of conquest and colonization of the American West. And I just kept thinking to myself, well, I keep going to all those places, and that's not what they say. They say out West, they would have been miserable and you would have hated it. And the soldier's life was terrible, and desertion was a third of the army every year. Mm. And so I decided that I wanted to resolve that kind of problem and take those two historiographies, which have often not been in conversation or sort of have been wrestled reluctantly into conversation, and try and actually see if I could figure out why there is an impression that the Civil War created this fundamentally new and different army, while at the same time in these kind of public history sites, why it's not being interpreted that way. And so the book that I wrote was my attempt to answer that question. And I think I got fortunate you can try to predict, and you know, for graduate students who listen to this, you can try to predict what the trends are going to be. You can try and sort of figure out if you can write that dissertation that's going to be the cutting edge thing. You can't gamify the market. I got lucky. There's a whole wave of historians, and many of them have been on your show, John, that work on the Civil War in the West. It's a new and emerging kind of field. And so I'm excited I get to join that conversation, but I just got lucky in my timing. It wasn't a planned kind of attack to try and join this conversation. Though if you have advice for how someone can do that, I'm sure the grad students would love to hear it, because it would be nice to be on trend. It's so hard to predict where the field's going to go, but right now this is kind of where it's tending, at least part of it. Civil War historians are cantankerous. They like to go their own way. So, some of them are willingly going that way and others are less willingly going that way, but they're going. So that's kind of where I sit, and that's how I came to write the book that I wrote, I think. At least that's what I've convinced myself. So there's history and memory. That's my...
That's a great description of why it works. Yep. And it's also good for anyone listening or watching to understand that it's awesome to have a good network of peers and colleagues to help you along the way with getting the word out there about what you're doing. Because when your peers and colleagues are excited about what you're doing, then it's a whole different ballgame, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so I've had sort of wonderful... So mentors in all kinds of different ways. So sort of either implicitly or explicitly. My graduate school advisor was Bill Blair at Penn State. He taught me how to write better. He was a journalist before he decided to become a historian. So he has this uncanny ability to find an incredible quote, you know, like they do in a newspaper where it's like they managed to interview, you know, he would tell me, you know, you've quoted four people here. Pick the good quote. Put the other three in the footnotes, stop boring everybody, you know? And my undergraduate advisor was Gary Gallagher, who kind of, he knows everybody in the Civil War field and has kind of steadfastly supported this project. And he always reminds me, and I'm sure he said it on your show, you know, follow the evidence. And that's what I tried to do. If you follow the evidence, you can't go wrong. And I was amazed as I wrote my book, how much evidence I had for my argument. And then I've had some great mentors in Western history, too, who I feel like don't get mentioned so much on the kind of Civil War podcast, but they've been sort of relentlessly helpful in kind of teaching me to get the word out about my book. So folks like Ari Kelman and Andy Graybill, who have been wonderful kind of in helping me speak to that field, which is not my natural kind of disposition. So yeah, I've been super, super fortunate to have good people looking out for me. And I think I remembered them all in the acknowledgments, but I'll say to anyone I forgot, I'm sorry.
It happens. It happens. Yeah. But yes, we can't remember everybody, but we sure try to do that. Cecily, when I started to dive into the book and thumb through it originally, because I usually just skim through first before I read to see where we're heading, I immediately realized that I've been wrong about the U.S. Army from the antebellum era and the post-war era. So I was really excited to dive deeper and to realize why I was wrong. And did you have a similar experience at all growing up in the West and hearing about things out there? Like you said, you kind of alluded to it. But as far as the size of the military force compared to the post-Civil War era, did you also have that kind of a aha moment, or were you kind of already thinking that way?
It's a good question. So for the pre-war period, like everybody else, I've always sort of been told it was a tiny army, and that's why it was so unprepared to fight the Civil War. And, you know, it was only 16 regiments. It was a small army. But if you look at the way that they were scattered all across the country, you really can see a pattern, and they were being used quite strategically. So even though it was a small army, it was being used to really great effect, because Southern Democrats were very explicit in placing the army in positions to help slavery expand into Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. Then they hoped Kansas and Nebraska as well. And then after the Civil War, I would say from growing up, I had a sense that it was a small army, but I also had a sense of, and this is what I think sometimes folks who kind of write from the Eastern perspective lack, how big the West is. And, you know, that you also have to have a sense of, even if there were technically more soldiers, the space that they had to cover, you know, if you've ever stood in the middle of Wyoming, first of all, I'm sorry for whatever took you to that place in your life, but you'll know, like, it's wind, it's tumbleweeds, it's the occasional antelope. And you can imagine, if you're out there and you've been told to go find somebody, your first thought would be, where am I supposed to, like, it's just vast emptiness. And so I had a real sense of place, I think, and a way to relate that size to the place. I think if you've never been to the West, it's harder to do that. And you know, like I said, I've spent plenty of time in North Dakota, and you know, most Americans will get to a lot of states in their lifetime. And I think for those who get to all 50, North Dakota is often the last one, because people have this genuine sense that there's nothing to see there. There's incredible things to see there, but it is just this perception of kind of vast emptiness. And so regardless of the size of the army, the task that they had in front of them was gargantuan. And it's really funny, because I can say that time and again, and again, unless you've literally stood there, like, even you can't really capture it on film and video. Like, I don't know, have you ever been to the Grand Canyon?
No, I've never been. I've only ever once been west of the Mississippi River.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, when you see the Grand Canyon in pictures, I'm sure you think in your mind, like, it's big.
Right.
But when you look into it, it's like, no, I had no idea how big this thing was. And so that's kind of the experience. And that's what the Army's leadership, kind of, when they're talking about, when they're trying to communicate to politicians in Washington who have also never been west of the Mississippi, they're like, you do not understand how much you're asking us to do and how much space there is out here. I mean, I think I did the calculations. There's like one soldier for every 5 or 6 square miles of territory. And one guy can't even do that in a day. And they're in these little kind of pockets, and it's imperfect. You can't respond to everywhere all the time. And nowadays we have a sense that at the drop of a hat, our soldiers could be wherever they need to be, not just in the US, but anywhere in the world. And they just didn't have that capability. So they are a small army after the war. They eventually kind of settle around 25,000 for the West. And they find it a really tough job. And again, a third of that army deserts year over year, because, again, they people can just walk off. No one's going after that guy. Like,
yeah, you're not going to find them.
You know, good luck to him. Yeah. I've been watching this show. It's on Amazon. It's a co-production of the BBC and the Amazon. It's called The English. It's about the kind of postbellum West. There's some soldiers in it, but it's funny. They're like in Wyoming and Nebraska, and they're supposed to be riding across these vast spaces, and yet they keep running into the protagonists and antagonists, just keep running into each other. And I'm like, the only unbelievable thing about this, it's really good on its history. The only unbelievable thing about it is how they keep finding each other out there, because there's no way they were just, you don't randomly run into someone, but it's the size of it that I think it's impossible to convey in writing as well. Like, I can break down the statistics that way, but one thing I wish the book could do is, like, you could open it and kind of just suddenly be standing there and seeing it. And I know, you know, Gary told me he went to Montana a few years back, and he had lived in Texas, and Texas is big. And Montana's not that big, but something about the curve of the earth or whatever, but the sky is just bigger. It is. It's truly just, you know, it's something about the vastness of it. But yeah, so I think it's really hard for folks who haven't been that way to understand the task the Army had to do. And when you add on the fact that they also had to deal with Reconstruction, it becomes, you know, an even bigger, even more impossible task to achieve. I don't know if that answers the question, but that kind of, that's how that Western experience kind of, I'll also note, as a Westerner, as a Coloradan, you know, I went to Banff as a kid because we thought, oh, we'll go see the Canadian Rockies. And we got there and we were like, oh, so it's the same. We sort of turned around and went home. We were like,
yeah,
oh.
It's the same. Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much.
It's gorgeous, but it's the same.
Yeah. Yeah. And on the prairies out up here, even less people than down in the United States. Yeah. So it's really strange because I believe it's most people live within 110 miles of the US border here in Canada. Yeah. So you get out there in the West and you go 250 miles north of the border and there's nobody.
Right.
And that's like that's to the Arctic. It's crazy.
Yeah, I've been to the only Canadian provinces I've been to are the prairie provinces. I'd love to go to eastern ones. And
a
good friend who lives in Halifax, but I don't know how I'm ever going to get to Nova Scotia. It just seems so far away, but I'd love to see it.
There you go, everybody. Buy more books and Cecily can get to the get to the Maritimes and talk about that kind of history as well. Look, dress like the Gorton fisherman and you'll be good to go. Before we dive into the ideas of around Manifest Destiny and the Antebellum era a little bit more, I do want to give a shout out to your book cover. And we talked a little bit about this before we came on here, but the book cover is absolutely insane in a great way. And I would love to know where this came from and the little secret behind it as well that you showed me that I had no idea was going on.
Yeah. So I've been telling people that I contacted the ghost of Thomas Nast and he whipped that up for me, but he actually just, you know, Thomas Nast, the great political satirist cartoonist who drew lots of Harper's Weekly covers and usually, you know, drew something in opposition to whatever the present day kind of political mania was, which means that, you know, his own politics are hard to chart because he was sort of more an oppositionalist than he was any kind of idealist. But he drew this for a Harper's Weekly cover in the late 1870s. And the U.S. Congress had passed another bill to reduce the army, which they essentially do year over year. After the Civil War, they just try to shrink the army. And obviously what he's trying to convey is the language that leading army officers use, that the army is a skeleton. It's not an army at all. It's basically bones. There's no flesh on this. We have no men. We have no ability to actually do the jobs that you want us to do. It's a kind of a skeleton impaling himself in front of an image of Columbia. It's just a great cartoon. So it's a Thomas Nast Harper's Weekly cover. And I didn't know LSU did this. They didn't tell me. It was like a little surprise for me to sort of uncover. And so obviously I've been telling everyone, but if you actually take the jacket off, the image is imprinted on the front boards of the book, which is so super cool. It was so cool that they did that. And I'm so grateful to them because I kind of, some LSU books are just printed. They print the cover directly on the boards. They don't all come with a jacket, but I said, it's my first book and I'm a real book nerd and I would just love to have a jacket. And they were like, yeah, we'll do a jacket. And then they did that little extra bit. So I was just, they did a great job. They made all my crazy Excel spreadsheet charts look like real charts and graphs and everything. So I had there's a lot of numbers in the book, a lot of data, and they just made it all look really good. So it's a super cool image. And there was another one I wanted, and folks can look it up. It's got a great tagline too. It was another year and another army reduction bill, but it shows kind of the U.S. Congress, and there's a wood picket fence in front of the Capitol building and Uncle Sam's kind of sitting on a stump, and there's a soldier kind of with his knees drawn up in front of him. And again, a skeleton kind of face. And the kind of punchline or the tagline for the cartoon was, "Uncle, this reminds me of Andersonville." So again, just conveying like how poorly treated the professional regular army was. And maybe that's something we talk about next is, I think something about the book that surprises people is that anti-militarism, because they probably assume I'm talking about like every single soldier in the Civil War era, and I'm really talking about a small subsection. And that's one of the key things that I hope the book will remind people about, is this question of like, there are multiple different types of armies that we have in this period of US history. And my interest is really in that professional army, that regular army of the United States that nobody really likes all that much. But so that's the kind of, that's what I'm referring to with the anti-militarism. Because obviously book titles are book titles, but I think that it throws up a major flare for people when they're like, wait, she's claiming that nobody liked the army during the Civil War. No, right. I promise. I'm really not.
Yeah, there was definitely a stark difference between how the regular army was seen and how the volunteer force was seen. It all goes back to trust, right?
Right, right. And this is, I get a real kind of bugbear about, there's been conversation among Civil War historians, and people come down different ways about this, but about wanting to call, not wanting to use the term Union Army anymore. And instead calling every soldier who fought in the Civil War, saying they fought in the U.S. Army, because it grants more legitimacy, like they were fighting for the United States. But the U.S. Army was never incorporated with the Union armies, which were the federalized volunteer armies, were the Union armies, and they were called that at the time. The U.S. Army was the regular professional army, which was purposefully kept separate because its soldiers and officers could not be trusted to intermingle with citizen soldier volunteers. And so that's one of my real kind of things I'll stand really firm about. I mean, I'm not going to wade into the, well, I don't know, we call it Twitter X, whatever. I'm not going to actually wade into the discourse. But I have sort of strong thoughts about it because if you actually pay attention to what's going on at the time, the U.S. Army is a very different thing to the Union Army. The Union Volunteer Army is 97% of soldiers who serve in the war. The U.S. Army, the regular army, is only 3%. And again, they're kept totally separate because they're viewed as aristocratic. They're viewed as martinets. They're viewed as conservative with a lowercase c, but also strongly suspected to be Democrats with a capital D, and therefore opposed emancipation. And there, of course, avatar is George McClellan. Professional soldiers are all seen to be these kind of McClellan-esque figures who do not want to fight the same kind of war that the Republican Party, which is in full majority in Congress and the presidency, wants them to fight. And they don't want to actually take the war to the Confederates. It's the volunteers and the volunteer officers who kind of are willing to do that. Of course, it's very silly to say that. Plenty of West Point graduates helped lead the Union to victory. Among them, U.S. Grant and William Tecumseh Sherman and Philip Sheridan. But keep in mind that a lot of those guys were soldiers who had gotten out of the Army in the 1850s and pursued careers in civilian lives and come back. So they're a little less suspect. But if you were in the Army all the way through, if you were a guy like George Meade or George McClellan, I'm pretty suspicious. McClellan does get out for just a second, but you're viewed as pretty suspicious by virtue of your association with this hierarchical, aristocratic, frankly, un-American institution. Because as we know, this debate goes back to the founding era. Standing armies are antithetical to democratic republics. And George Washington has to deal with this at Newburgh when his soldiers threaten to, you know, march on the Continental Congress. And he's like, y'all, no, they already don't like you. You can't, you know, he has to defuse this conspiracy before the Republic goes up in flames, before it's even gotten going, because standing armies are Caesar-esque, they're Cromwell-esque, they're Napoleon-esque, and they're threats to democracy. And so you have to keep them small. You have to send them far away from the centers of population and power. So send them out west in the American case, and don't trust them for a second, unless you figure out how to make them your tool, which is what slaveholders do in the 1850s, is they kind of weaponize the army, no pun intended, to help slavery expand into the West.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more on that, Cecily, because when people will look at your book title, some people don't see the scope of the Civil War era. They think it's just 1861, 1865. And a lot of us have redefined, or not redefined, but we we have labeled Civil War era as being, you know, both bookends as well of the Civil War era, because you can't tell one story without telling the next iteration of it. That army that Grant and others were a part of in 1848 and other eras in the antebellum years. What was that army like as far as being funded and placed compared to what they'll witness later on?
Sure. So they were their best selves, I would say. They were kind of, if you could have chosen any decade to be a professional soldier, you would have chosen the 1850s, because not only was the army expanding and its funding was increasing year over year, they added 4 regiments, which is a huge number of soldiers to add. It's the largest increase to the army up until that point, outside of a period of actual war. So obviously they kind of have a dry run for the Civil War in Mexico. A lot of the professional officers from West Point get a real taste of what leadership is like in Mexico. But they go back, the army contracts in the 1850s after the war with Mexico. But then you have the election of Franklin Pierce in 1852. So a dough face, one of these, as we call them, a northern man with southern principles. So he's a northern guy. He's not a slaveholder himself, but he supports slaveholding policies. And most importantly, he supports the kind of rights of slaveholders to carry their enslaved people into the West. And he appoints Jefferson Davis as his Secretary of War. Davis himself, a graduate of West Point, a veteran of the Mexican War, one of the wealthiest men in America, one of the largest slaveholders in the South, and a tireless advocate for slave expansion. And Davis understands how to work the War Department to his favor. And so he proposes a 4-regiment increase to the Army. One of the units that gets created out of that is the 2nd Cavalry. Its officers include Albert Sidney Johnston, Robert E. Lee, Jeb Stuart. You have George Thomas, who's a Virginian and is assumed to have Southern sympathies. Obviously, we know he ends up choosing to turn his back on Virginia, unlikely. And so you have all these guys who are going to become basically leading lights in the Confederate Army in this single regiment, which after the war, people are like, that's a little weird that Jefferson Davis did that. I mean, it's totally coincidental, but right. Jefferson Davis did make sure that he put his best soldiers in these new regiments, which went to Texas and to the southern kind of tier of the country, and helped pave the way for slavery to move into Texas, to move further west into Texas. Davis oversees several railroad surveys, 4 different routes that the Transcontinental Railroad might go. He puts more time and money into surveying the southern route that would cut across Texas. He advocates for that one to Congress. A third of the army is in Texas alone prior to the war. Another third is in New Mexico and Arizona. And the rest are scattered across California and the Pacific coast. There's really almost no attention to the Great Plains. But I think the most kind of galling thing that Pierce and Davis do is in the crisis in Kansas, in the debate over whether Kansas will have a slave kind of constitution or a free state constitution. Davis and Pierce approve the use of the army to disperse the free state legislature of Kansas and actually force the advocates of free Kansas to break up their meeting to approve the constitution of Kansas that would have made it, had it come into the Union as a free state at gunpoint, literally at the point of a bayonet. And for a lot of people, this is a really kind of shocking moment that U.S. soldiers are being sent to basically deny the First Amendment rights of citizens who are meeting fully in accordance with their kind of constitutional ability to do so, and being told that the president and the army will not let them kind of approve this free constitution. And the army becomes painted essentially as a weapon of these slaveholding politicians, what the Republican Party, as it comes into being, will label the slave power.
Mm-hmm. That carries over very long term and has implications for well beyond Kansas and the spread into Texas. Is this where we start to really see that party divide just concrete itself in Washington, D.C., where there's definitely a dividing line between the idea of using this army to increase power in general and they also having this other side saying, we don't even like this idea in the first place, and now it's being used by someone else to their political advantage.
Right, exactly. And so in 1854, when those four regiments are added to the army, it's a fairly uncontested vote, actually. The Whig Party voted about the same in terms of military issues as the Democrats. So the Whigs were not an explicitly kind of anti-army party. But I make the argument in the book that sort of basically after the crisis in Kansas, as the Republican Party comes into being, in part inspired by that crisis or galvanized by it, they make anti-militarism a centerpiece of their political thinking. Because as we know, the Republican Party platform in 1860, it has one plank, the non-extension of slavery into the territories. If you follow the logic of that, the one tool that has helped slavery expand time and time again is the army. And the army has been a tool of slaveholders. So to be anti-slavery, as the Republicans claim to be, is also to be in opposition to the army. And when the Civil War breaks out after Lincoln's election and 313 officers of the United States Army resign their commissions and join a war of treason against the federal government, all those Republicans who are now the majority because their Democratic colleagues have left are like, see, we told you. And even though the majority far and away of soldiers stay, and even though many Southern-born soldiers like George Thomas stay and fight for the Union, Winfield Scott, another great example, they're still like, well, we can't trust you because you've been under the influence, you've been under the thumb of these slaveholders, and you have to prove to us that you can fight this war to win the Union. But when George McClellan is the first guy that you choose to put in charge, you know, you're basically just confirming what you already believed, is that professional soldiers are not going to be the guys who have what it takes to win the war. And my favorite example of this in the book is an Ohio senator named John Sherman, who's constantly writing letters to his brother about how professional soldiers are terrible and they're not going to be able to win the war. And you know, they're actively detrimental to the Union war effort. And his brother happens to be William Tecumseh Sherman, who I'm sure was receiving those letters like, what do you want me to do? Like, I'm not sure what course of action you'd like me to pursue here, but like, give us a chance, you know, let us, you know, at least try. And so, so like, even at the level of, you know, a Republican senator whose brother is going to be one of the three most important soldiers in the entire war, he's like, I don't know. I don't trust you people throughout the entirety of the war. And it doesn't change, you know, when McClellan is out. And it doesn't change when Grant comes in. I think Grant's viewed as too kind of insulated from politics to be really appealing to the Republicans either way. Grant was kind of very studied in his unwillingness to put his thumb on the political scale. The other problem is the very few Republican officers they can identify are John Pope. And yeah. That's not right. It's not going to work. So
yeah.
They have that problem, which is a secondary, but also, you know, difficult problem for them. Cause the few guys that they have, the John Fremonts and the John Popes, are like middling to bad in terms of their military ability.
This leads into this idea of the Committee on the Conduct of the War then, right? Because you have this disconnect of trust, and it's almost like kind of like what we see in our modern political sense, where if someone does something and they're of a different thought process, political party, whatever, you immediately have to have an investigation. And exactly. It seems like the Committee on the Conduct of the War is kind of like the great, great grandfather of that movement, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Guys with absolutely no military experience, not a single one of them had ever picked up a musket, let alone fired one. They probably would have run away in fear. They're like, we have some very serious opinions about how this war should be being waged. And we're gonna grill these generals about every decision they make on the battlefield with no context for the stress, pressure, chaos of a battlefield. And then we're going to issue incredibly lengthy reports explaining what we think they could have done better. They're amazing documents. And there's really only one book on the Joint Committee. It's a wonderful book by a historian named Bruce Tapp, but they are a group that deserves to be studied more. It's a joint committee, of course, and they put some Democrats on there, but they put basically ones that are so junior that they can have no real effect. It's basically radical Republicans kind of running roughshod over the party, but it's very funny. Though they do very serious investigations into a series of disasters, and they actually do one of three congressional investigations into the massacre at Sand Creek. So they do some sort of really interesting and good things as well. But they're, for the most part, they just kind of make themselves look pretty silly. And the generals just, it's a thorn in their side. You have letters from Meade, McClellan, what have you. It's like, I have to go before the Joint Committee today. It's just going to be an absolute waste of time. Meanwhile, John Pope's like, when can I come in? I'd love to come talk to you about what I think. And they're like, yes, please come. And they just kind of, sit there and pump each other up. But and then they're like, okay, now go do something. And Pope's like, I would rather not. I'll go up to Minnesota and propose an invasion of Canada, which is my favorite thing John Pope does in the Civil War. He's like, so all of the Sioux and Lakota, they run into Canada. So the best thing we could do is chase them into Canada. And Lincoln is like, absolutely not. No. You've done enough.
No. Yeah. It's not going to work. And I hear about that plenty up here. Yeah. because I'm in War of 1812 country. I hear about it plenty when they hear my accent. And they're like, yeah, we beat you twice. And it's like, yeah, I get it. Okay.
And you're like, nobody in America knows what that war is. It's fine.
No. Yeah. No one knows what this is. It's fine. Yeah. You can have it. How did Sicily, this might be a little bit out of the scope, but I think it's something worth noting, is how do you think these politicians and their constituents saw the Union Army veteran as compared to the U.S. Army veteran in the post-Civil War years? Did they see this group as the true hero and this group as the, okay, you were there, happy for you, but we still don't trust you? Or what was that kind of a historical memory case on the war itself for those two?
You've put your finger right on it. I mean, the Union veteran is the best thing that you could be in the 19th century, in terms of sort of whether or not the public is going to like you. If you're a citizen soldier volunteer who picked up his musket like George Washington or Cincinnatus and then put it down and went home, 10 out of 10, no further questions. Here's your pension check. Please vote Republican at the next national election. The professional soldier, I mean, he's a soldier for life. And he probably doesn't vote, or the suspicion is he votes conservative, and he's really out of sight, out of mind, kind of on the Western frontier. There's a great story of a New York socialite who's walking down the street. She's introduced to a regular army officer about like 1878. It's repeated in sort of army circles. And she goes, oh, I thought the army was disbanded after the war. Just like had no idea that an army still existed. Kind of a thing. I mean, it's to the point where politicians make meal out of this contrast between the professional army and the citizen soldiers. And John Logan, who is a volunteer officer, who has several axes to grind against various professional sort of U.S. regular officers, chief among them William Tecumseh Sherman, who will become general in chief of the U.S. Army, decides to use this example of, wouldn't you rather spare the money you were proposing to give the army a raise next year and spend it on the widows and the orphans and the, wounded men of our veteran kind of class? And wouldn't you rather take that money? And he's literally saying all this while Sherman is sitting up in the balcony of the, of of Congress, like, listening. And Logan's like, and I just really don't think William Tecumseh Sherman deserves to get a raise. And it's just going on and on and on. And again, I don't know. William Tecumseh Sherman's my favorite character in the book. And it's hard not to love him. But he just, like, you can just picture him at various points just rolling his eyes. And it really makes, like, all of his grievance against politics, which everybody kind of loves to quote, you know, Sherman, you know, I will not run if nominated and will not serve if elected. It makes a lot more sense when you dig into all of this material about, you know, politicians were really mean to him all of the time and constantly trying to undermine his ability to do his job. And he was like, I'm literally just doing the job that you are asking me to do as the federal government. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you're asking me to do all of this. And on the other hand, you're telling me that I'm trash and you're not going to give me the funding or the supplies or the men to actually do the job you're asking me to do. So, you know, he literally throws up his hands and moves Army headquarters to St. Louis because he's like, I just can't deal with politics anymore. But yeah, that's exactly right. It's the professionals who we need to reduce in their power. We need to underfund them, or we need to defund them and reduce their numbers. And we can take all those savings and we can transfer them into the lovely pensions that we're going to pay to the Union veterans. And so, yeah, it's viewed as like a zero sum game between the two, because supporting one would mean harming the other.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that had an impact on Reconstruction? Because if you are constantly undermining the budget of the U.S. Army, and they are also supposed to be keeping the peace, quote unquote, in the South, doesn't that have a long-term effect on Reconstruction efforts?
Yeah, I think the way I put it in the book, I genuinely think that this is where you see Republican rhetoric kind of outracing their actual political will. And so, you know, I think Eric Foner's Unfinished Revolution, you know, Reconstruction America's Unfinished Revolution, is still one of the best books on the topic. He calls it an unfinished revolution. I would say one of the reasons it doesn't sort of fully match up to the rhetoric, especially the radical Republicans who want to fully remake the South, is that, they don't effectively use their best tool for doing so. And so they grudgingly admit that they need to keep an army in the South. They try to arrange it so that they have officers that they trust in charge. So Oliver Otis Howard, trustworthy, stick him in charge of the Freedmen's Bureau. He's a safe figure we can work with. The second Phil Sheridan gets a little antsy down in Louisiana, he's out. You're going back west. We can't kind of work with you. So they're very careful in who they select and who they choose. But at the same time, they're so focused on this idea that they need to reduce the bureaucracy that the war created. They need to bring down the super inflated federal budgets from the war. The federal budget exceeds $1 billion for the first time at the end of the war, and they need to cut that spending. And they are so committed to this idea that the army is the best place where you can save money that they're constantly reducing the budget and the number of troops. And so they're undercutting their own ability to do their job. And if you actually look at the numbers and where troops are being sent and deployed, the vast majority, the largest decreases in troops in the South happened in 1870, 71, and 72. And I think that's a clear indication that as a matter of political kind of policy or enforceable policy, Reconstruction is really over by 1872. And this lines up with the return of every single former Confederate state has by 1872 returned a constitution that has been approved by the federal government, can now send representatives back to Congress. Its citizens are eligible to vote again. It's kind of fully re-recognized as a state. And so we say that Reconstruction goes on into 1876, but I think a lot of that is less about politics and actual kind of measurable change, because you don't have the agents to enforce that change in the South. They're all kind of drifting back to the West, or they're being cut entirely from the army. So I think the numbers really show a stark kind of story there. And that's one thing I try to make an argument about in the book.
Mm. Well, you do it very well, Cecily. I really did enjoy the book, honestly. And it was when I was told about the book by Gary Gallagher, and he's like, you have to read this and you have to have Cecily on for an interview. And I'm like, yes, sir, I'll do both. Because like we said before, it's Gary. And when Gary orders you to do something, you do it. He orders in a nice way.
That's right. Yeah. Suggest. That's right. Yeah.
He pokes you in a direction and you're like, I felt that. I know what you're trying to do. Yes, sir.
And it's one of the great joys for me was whenever I could send him a page and he would say, I didn't know that. And I was always like, hooray, wow, I found a new thing. If it's new to Gary, I think it's really must be new because he knows about everything there is to know about this era. So,
yes, the mentor of so many.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know,
we can't calculate how many it is.
No.
But when I first heard about the book and got the book and saw the title, I'm like, okay, what direction are we going to go here? And so I wanted to make sure that I had you on to discuss the title as far as how that intersects with what's inside the book. Yeah. And over basically three generations of the U.S. / Union Army, because I'm guilty of saying the U.S. Army in the Civil War. So I have to... Yeah. Rethink.
It's fine. I'm not gonna change the world on this topic, but I do. It's like my little my brain, I'm like, no, but it's fine. Yeah. I understand the argument for it, and I understand that there are good reasons, but I would argue it's historically inaccurate, and it just depends how much of a stickler you want to be. And I'm a pretty cantankerous I think my main role model in life is Oscar the Grouch from Sesame Street. No. So I'm pretty happy to be.
Oh no, I'm more like Gonzo off the Muppets. So it's okay.
That's okay. That's good.
I have the funny cardigans too, so we're good.
That's perfect.
What are you going to work on next, Cecily? Anything in particular, or you have a specific interest you're wanting to finally get to after writing this book, or what's next?
It's
for
a
you
good.
In general?
This is the you're now free from graduate school question. I am really excited. I'm working with a couple of colleagues. I already mentioned one, Andrew Graybill, but then another, Jeff Engel, who's a historian of the Cold War, sort of U.S. We're putting together a conference that will produce an edited volume on the frontier in the American presidency. So we're kind of asking, how did the American West influence presidents and vice versa? And so we have scholars talking about from Jefferson to Trump. We're going to have 10 great historians, including T.J. Stiles, in the book, and it's going to be kind of super cool. I'm writing an essay on Lincoln and the multiple attempts to bring Colorado into the Union during the Civil War. It fails to come in, even though Nevada does. And so I'm going to kind of compare those two and talk about kind of territorial politics in the Civil War. I'm participating in another symposium about rethinking the Indian Wars. I'm going to write a piece about how the Second Seminole War shapes William Tecumseh Sherman's ideas about total war and kind of see if there are antecedents of the March to the Sea in his experience in Florida. And then book-wise, I'm not sure, I might stick with the Lincoln theme. There are not that many for all the books on Lincoln, books about Lincoln in the West. So I'm considering kind of writing maybe a short but kind of punchy book about that. I'm also really interested in something that comes up in this book, but is not fully explored, but territorial militias is another type of military unit that exists in the West and their relationship, especially to kind of the violence of Western settlement. So those are a few of the kind of things. I'm kind of feel like I'm constantly doing something, but I'm most excited about this presidency and the frontiers thing, because I think it's going to be a lot of fun to see what people come up with. We're pretty excited. So it'll be a public event here in Dallas in October, and then the book will follow, 18 months, 2 years down the line. You know, you're relying on multiple people, right, to meet deadlines, but we're really excited about it. So it should be a lot of fun.
That's great. Please let me know more information about that. I can pass that on to my listeners and watchers and let everyone know about that. Cause I'm sure I have a few colleagues and friends who are in Texas or surrounding that massive area. And we'd love to stop in.
We could get a panel together for you to have on the show. This works so well.
Sure. I'd love to do that. I'd love to help out in any way I can. So
that's great. Thank you, Doug.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for coming on and talking about your book, Cecily. It really does mean a lot to me that you talked about this. And I'm so glad to see Civil War scholarship going off in many directions now, instead of just the kind of books that I grew up with, maybe that you grew up with too. We're starting to go in so many different directions because it needs to be done. And I can't wait to see what comes out next and what you work on next. I'm sure it's going to be awesome.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah. I feel lucky to be part of a generation that's kind of pushing those boundaries. So yeah, I have a lot of fun. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.